Providers who submit their email address as part of their application will receive application status notifications, including details on how to use their card if approved. In addition to the online applications, the MBTA recently removed rider photos, names, and expiration dates from Senior Charlie cards for people 65 and older to simplify the card fulfillment process for these riders. Riders who apply for a new or replacement Senior Charlie card will now receive the new reduced fare Charlie cards for seniors, which are valid for 8 years. Riders with current Senior Charlie cards can utilize them until they expire. To learn more about the MBTA's free and reduced fare programs and how to apply online, visit this website, mbta.com/fares/reduced. That again, mbta.com/fares/reduced.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleborough, WRS Middleborough, WRSLP Pittsfield, WLLA Londonderry, WBAOFP Athol, WDJN Framingham.
Coming up next from the Talking Information Center, news stories from the Brockton Enterprise.
The Enterprise, Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. Brockton residents oppose apartments. Some Brockton residents are up in arms as a 10-unit luxury apartment building is planned to be constructed in their neighborhood. Located at 48 North Pearl Street next to the new Brockton Behavioral Health Center, property owner Douglas King plans to turn the old office building on the property into a 2-unit apartment building and add an 8-unit apartment complex. Some residents oppose the plan, saying that it's out of character for the neighborhood. Additionally, the property is zoned for commercial use and not residential use, and King's lawyer, James Burke, said that there is no plan to change the zoning designation. It's really mystifying because there are no other commercial uses, said Burke. This is really an appropriate reuse, and it's one that will be in much more harmony with the neighborhood. Yet some residents are opposing the plan, urging the Brockton Planning Board to reconsider its approval for the site. How can they even contemplate this proposal, said Paul Ware, a resident of the neighborhood. We just think that there is something underhanded going on here. King is a developer who only builds luxury apartments, according to Burke, and that's exactly what he intends to build, he said. An old, two-story house with chipped white siding that houses Burke's law offices sits on the property. King plans to renovate the building into 2 apartments, originally planning to add a 10-unit apartment building, totaling 12 units on the property. The Brockton Planning Board approved the plans in May. On June 14th, Burke and King went before the Brockton Zoning Board of Appeals, hoping for 2 variances to be approved, but the ZBA denied the variances, stating that there was no substantial hardship and there needed to be a fire lane and more parking. Ware said that a handful of residents attended the ZBA meeting and advocated against approving the developer's plans. Following the ZBA hearing, King and Burke returned to the drawing board. They shrunk the new apartment building from 10 units to 8, added a fire lane, and a bigger parking lot. With new plans in mind, King and Burke reapplied to return to the ZBA. The planning board hearing deciding if they can return to the zoning board will take place at the next meeting in November, but the board's report on the matter released on September 1st said that since no new and substantially different information has been presented pertaining to that official basis of denial, the proposal does not merit a return to the ZBA, regardless of any other revisions made. The area surrounding the proposed building is mainly comprised of single-family homes. The plot, designated as a C5 commercial zone, is adjacent to Brockton's newest mental health inpatient hospital on one of the neighborhood's main roads. We simply do not understand how either the Planning Board or the Zoning Board of Appeals can even begin to contemplate approving variances to a C5 zone so that a multifamily residential unit can be built there, Ware said. It doesn't make legal sense to us at all, he said. According to Burke, not only is it legal, but the neighbor's argument is illogical. Brockton City Councilor Winthrop Farwell said that the proposed building has precipitated a response from some residents that a catastrophe is upon us, and that he's having a hard time comprehending this attitude given what might be built on that property under present zoning. If we don't control the use of that property, something much more distasteful to the resident group may locate there. That is the bigger issue, in my opinion, he said. Still, nearby residents like Ware plan to attend the Planning Board meeting to share their concerns about the proposal. We don't want a multifamily apartment building in that zone and on the property, Ware said. Police open new public safety center at Westgate Mall. A new public safety center opened at Westgate Mall on Thursday, October 27th, according to Darren Duarte, spokesperson for the Brockton Police Department. The center is aimed at improving the quality of life for all residents in the city, according to a written statement. The police department partnered with the city and Westgate Mall to host a ribbon-cutting ceremony on Thursday afternoon. At the ceremony, Brockton Police Chief Brenda Perez and Mayor Robert Sullivan said a few words. The center will be a place where we can hold special events, conduct official business, and serve as an information hub, Perez said. It is a unique space where Brockton police officers and personnel can engage with the community, Sullivan said. On why the center is located at Westgate Mall? Chief Perez said the new space will enhance the department's community policing efforts and will support and unite all residents in the city. Public and private partnerships are vital to the success of any city, and Brockton is no exception. Westgate Mall continues to work closely with the Brockton Police Department to provide important community access to our local police, said Greg Farrington, general manager of Westgate Mall. The new center is located next door to Liam's Furniture and Golden Nails Salon at 200 Westgate Drive, Suite 7, Brockton, Mass. Roberts delays handover of Trump tax returns. Chief Justice John Roberts on Tuesday put a temporary hold on the handover of former President Donald Trump's tax returns to a congressional committee. Roberts' order gives the Supreme Court time to weigh the legal issues in Trump's emergency appeal to the High Court filed Monday. Without court intervention, the tax returns could have been provided as early as Thursday by the Treasury Department to the Democratic-controlled House Ways and Means Committee. Roberts gave the committee until November 10th to respond. The Chief Justice handles emergency appeals from the nation's capital, where the fight over Trump's taxes has been going on since 2019. Lower courts ruled that the committee has broad authority to obtain tax returns and rejected Trump's claims that it was overstepping. If Trump can persuade the nation's highest court to intervene in this case, he could potentially delay a final decision until the start of the next Congress in January. If Republicans recapture control of the House in the fall election, they could drop the records request. The temporary delay imposed by Roberts is the third such order issued by justices in recent days in cases related to Trump. The court separately is weighing Senator Lindsey Graham's emergency appeal to avoid having to testify before a Georgia grand jury that is investigating potential illegal interference by Trump and his allies in the 2020 election in the state. Also before the court is an emergency appeal from Arizona Republican Party Chairwoman Kelly Ward to prevent the handover of phone records to the House committee investigating the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The House Ways and Means panel and its chairman, Democrat Richard Neal of Massachusetts, first requested Trump's tax returns in 2019 as a part of an investigation into the Internal Revenue Service's audit program and tax law compliance by the former president. A federal law says the Internal Revenue Service shall furnish the returns of any taxpayer to a handful of top lawmakers. The Justice Department, under the Trump administration, had defended a decision by then-Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin to withhold the tax returns from Congress. Mnuchin argued that he could withhold the documents because he concluded they were being sought by Democrats for partisan reasons. A lawsuit ensued. After President Joe Biden took office, the committee renewed the request seeking Trump's tax returns and additional information from 2015 to 2020. The White House took the position that the request was a valid one and that the Treasury Department had no choice but to comply. Trump then attempted to halt the handover in court. Agency inspects Russia's unfounded dirty bomb claim. Experts from the United Nations Nuclear Power Agency inspected two sites in Ukraine on Tuesday that Russia identified in unfounded claims that Ukrainian authorities planned to set off radioactive dirty bombs in their own invaded country. Russian strikes targeting eight regions of southeastern Ukraine killed at least four civilians and wounded four others in 24 hours, the Ukrainian president's office said. Tens of thousands of people face power blackouts and water shortages following Russian shelling of energy infrastructure in 10 regions on Monday. International Atomic Energy Agency Director General Rafael Grossi said the inspections for evidence of a so-called dirty bomb requested by Kyiv in the wake of the unsubstantiated Russian allegations would be completed soon. In the wake of battlefield setbacks for Russia in its war in Ukraine, top Russian officials, including President Vladimir Putin, made unsubstantiated accusations that Ukraine was manufacturing such an explosive device which scatters radioactive waste. The Russians, without providing evidence, alleged the Ukrainians planned to make the purported bomb look like Russia's doing. Russia's UN ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, alleged in a letter to the Security Council members last week that Ukraine's nuclear research facility and mining company received direct orders from President Volodymyr Zelensky's regime to develop such a dirty bomb. Western nations have called Moscow's repeated claim transparently false. Ukrainian authorities dismissed it as an attempt to distract attention from Moscow's own alleged plans to detonate a dirty bomb as a way to justify a further escalation of hostilities. The International Atomic Energy Agency has said the investigated sites are under IAEA safeguards and have been visited regularly by IAEA inspectors whose mission is detecting undeclared nuclear activities and materials related to the development of dirty bombs. The IAEA inspected one of the two locations a month ago, and no undeclared nuclear activities or materials were found there, the agency said in a statement on Monday. The UN's Atomic Energy Watchdog also has had on-site monitors at the Russian-occupied Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Fighting around and near Europe's largest nuclear power station has created worries of a possibly catastrophic leak there. The Ukrainian president's office said Tuesday that cities and towns around the plant experienced more heavy shelling between Monday and Tuesday. In Nikopol, a city which faces the plant from across the wide Dnieper River, over a dozen apartment buildings, a kindergarten, and various private businesses were damaged, the office said. Russian shelling hit 14 towns and villages in the eastern Donetsk region Monday and into Tuesday, destroying sections of railway track, damaging a power line, and taking down mobile communications in some areas. A missile also struck the city of Kramatorsk, which hosts the Ukrainian Army's headquarters. The shelling killed three civilians and wounded three others, the region's governor, Pavlo Krylenko, said. Donetsk is one of the four regions illegally annexed by Moscow last month and continues to see fierce clashes as Russian forces press their grinding attack on the cities of Bakhmut and Avdiivka. Another woman was killed after Russian rockets slammed into apartment buildings and a school in the southern city of Mykolaiv, its mayor reported Tuesday. Ukraine was still grappling Tuesday with the consequences of Monday's massive barrage of Russian strikes, which disrupted power and water supplies in multiple Ukrainian cities and villages. Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said authorities restored electricity and running water in the capital's residential buildings, but that rolling power outages would continue in the city because of significant power shortages. Kyiv Region Governor Oleksiy Kuluba said Tuesday that 20,000 apartments remained without power. Russia has opened an energy front and is using energy to blackmail the civilian population, provoking hunger and cold in Ukraine, Kuleba said on Ukrainian TV. Ukraine's state energy company, Ukrenergo, said in a statement Tuesday that seven regions would experience rolling blackouts to reduce the load on the energy grid, maintain a stable balance within the system, and avoid repeated failures. In Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city, subway service was suspended again on Tuesday, according to the subway's Telegram page. No reason for the suspension was given. In the occupied Kherson region, Russian-installed authorities sought to evacuate up to 70,000 more people living within 9 miles of the Dnieper River in anticipation of a Ukrainian counteroffensive pushing deeper into the region. The effort was already underway on Tuesday morning, according to the Kremlin-appointed governor of the region, Vladimir Saldo. In Russia, the regular fall draft got underway Tuesday with a total of 120,000 men expected to be conscripted within the next 2 months. Russian military officials have assured the conscripts will not be sent to fight in Ukraine, including to the annexed regions. This year's fall draft was scheduled to start in October, but was delayed by 1 month because of the partial mobilization of 300,000 men, which was declared completed on Monday. South Korean officials admit culpability in tragedy. Police officers' handling of urgent calls probed. South Korean officials admitted responsibility and apologized on Tuesday for failures in preventing and responding to a Halloween crowd surge that killed more than 150 people and left citizens shocked and angry. The government is facing growing public scrutiny over whether the crush Saturday night in Seoul's Itaewon District, a popular nightlife neighborhood, could have been prevented and who should take responsibility for the country's worst disaster in years. National Police Chief Yoon Hee Kyun said an initial investigation found there were many urgent calls from citizens notifying authorities about the potential danger of the crowd gathering in Itaewon. He said police officers who received the calls failed to handle them effectively. I feel a heavy responsibility for the disaster as the head of one of the related government offices, Yoon said in a televised news conference. People will do their best to prevent a tragedy like this from happening again. Yoon said police have launched an intense internal probe into the officers' handling of the emergency calls and other issues, such as the on-the-spot response to the crowd surge in Itaewon that night. Separately, South Korea's Interior Minister, Emergency Office Chief, Seoul Mayor, and the head of a ward office that includes the Itaewon neighborhood all offered public apologies. Seoul Mayor Oh Si-hoon apologized deeply and wept and briefly halted his news conference as he talked about the parent of a 20-year-old woman who was declared dead earlier in the day. When I tried to comfort a person with a daughter hospitalized at the National Medical Center yesterday, they said their daughter would survive, and they believe so, he said. But I heard she passed away this morning. I am sorry that my apology has come late. The disaster, which left at least 156 people dead and 151 others injured, was concentrated in a narrow downhill alley in Itaewon. Witnesses described people falling on one another, suffering severe breathing difficulties, and falling unconscious. They said rescuers and ambulances failed to reach the crammed alleys in time because the entire Itaewon area was packed with slow-moving vehicles and partygoers clad in Halloween costumes. Most of the dead were in their 20s and 30s, and about two-thirds were women. During a cabinet council meeting Tuesday, President Yoon Suk-yeol acknowledged that South Korea lacks research on crowd management. He called for the use of drones and other high-tech resources to develop an effective crowd control capability and said the government will soon meet with experts to review national safety rules. The crowd surge is South Korea's deadliest disaster since a 2014 ferry sinking that killed 304 people and exposed lax safety rules and regulatory failures. Saturday's surge has raised public questions about what South Korea has done since then to prevent human-made disasters. After the Itawan disaster, police launched a 475-member task force to find its cause. Wednesday Powerball prize soars to $1.2 billion. There were no big treats from the Halloween night Powerball drawing, as none of the tickets sold matched all six numbers. The lack of a winner means the next drawing Wednesday night will be for a massive $1.2 billion jackpot. The winning numbers drawn Monday were white balls 13, 19, 36, 39, 59, and the red Powerball 13. The jackpot will be the fourth largest in U.S. history. The biggest prize was a $1.586 billion Powerball jackpot won by three ticket holders in 2016. Massive lottery jackpots have become more common in recent years as lottery officials have adjusted game rules and ticket prices to pump up the top prizes. The most recent tweak came in August when Powerball officials added an additional drawing day, going from two a week to three, to build larger prizes and boost sales. Although the advertised top prize Wednesday will be an estimated $1.2 billion, that is for winners who receive their winnings through an annuity paid over 29 years. Winners almost always opt for cash, which for Wednesday night's drawing will be an estimated $596 million. No one has hit the jackpot since August 3rd, meaning there have now been 38 consecutive draws without a jackpot winner, a testament to how slim the odds are of winning the jackpot, one in 292.2 million. Powerball is played in 45 states as well as Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Stark facts emerge in the attack at Pelosi home. Court filing says suspect told police that he was on a suicide mission. The man accused of breaking into House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home, beating her husband, and seeking to kidnap her told police he was on a suicide mission and had plans to target other California and federal politicians, according to a Tuesday court filing. David DePape was ordered held without bail during his arraignment Tuesday in San Francisco Superior Court. His public defender entered a not guilty plea on his behalf. It was the first public appearance since the early Friday attack for DePape, a fringe activist drawn to conspiracy theories. In the court filing, prosecutors detailed the attack in stark terms as part of their bid to keep DePape behind bars. Paul Pelosi was knocked unconscious by the hammer attack and woke up in a pool of his own blood, the filing said. DePape's intent could not have been clearer, San Francisco District Attorney Brooke Jenkins wrote in the filing. He forced his way into the Pelosi home, intending to take the person third in line to the presidency of the United States hostage and to seriously harm her. Thwarted by Speaker Pelosi's absence, defendant continued on his quest and would not be stopped, culminating on the near-fatal attack on Mr. Pelosi. Without being questioned, DePape told officers and medics at the scene that he was sick of the lies coming out of Washington, D.C., the filing said. I didn't really want to hurt him, but you know, this was a suicide mission. I'm not going to stand here and do nothing, even if it cost me my life. DePape allegedly said he had other targets, including a local professor, as well as several prominent state and federal politicians and members of their families. The filing did not name any potential targets. This case demands detention, Jenkins wrote, nothing less. Wearing orange jail clothing, DePape only spoke to tell Judge Diane Northway how to pronounce his last name. The 42-year-old defendant, whose shoulder was dislocated during the arrest, is scheduled to return to court Friday. After the hearing, DePape's public defender, Adam Lipson, said he looks forward to providing DePape with a vigorous legal defense. We're going to be doing a comprehensive investigation of what happened. We're going to be looking into Mr. DePape's mental state, and I'm not going to talk any further about that until I have more information, Lipson said. He later said he was pleased that Paul Pelosi was improving and urged the public not to pass judgment on what he called a complicated situation. The attack on 82-year-old Paul Pelosi sent shockwaves through the political world just days before the hotly contested midterm elections. Threats against lawmakers and election officials have been at all-time highs in this first nationwide election since the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the Capitol, and authorities have issued warnings about rising extremism in the United States. DePape faces state charges of attempted murder, burglary, and elder abuse. He also faces federal charges including attempted kidnapping of a U.S. official. Those charges are outlined in an affidavit detailing the assault, which was largely captured on police body camera imagery after authorities responded to a 911 call from the Pelosi's Pacific Heights home. Jenkins' filing said, while Paul Pelosi was on the phone with the 911 operator, DePape was gesturing and telling him to hang up. Pelosi then told the dispatcher that he did not need police, fire, or medical assistance, but he instead asked for the Capitol Police because they are usually at the house protecting his wife. Moments later, the dispatcher heard him interacting with a man, and Paul Pelosi said, he thinks everything's good. I've got a problem, but he thinks everything's good. Speaker Pelosi was in Washington at the time and under the protection of her security detail, which does not extend to family members. She quickly returned to San Francisco, where her husband was hospitalized and underwent surgery for a skull fracture and other injuries. In Washington, U.S. Capitol Police Chief Tom Manger provided a sobering update Tuesday of security protocols for members of Congress. Manger said that although many improvements have been made since the Capitol attack, including the hiring of nearly 280 officers by the end of this year, there is still a lot of work to do. We believe today's political climate calls for more resources to provide additional layers of physical security for members of Congress, he said. Manger said the attack on Pelosi's husband was an alarming reminder of the dangerous threats elected officials and public figures face during today's contentious political climate. Taunton Fire might not move into new building. A new public safety building for Taunton's police and fire departments is one step closer to reality. The city recently hired a project manager and design and architect firm to begin the process of determining the what's, how's, and when's for this new public safety facility. This administration, this project team, with council support, will get this done. We have liftoff, said Patrick Delarusso, Taunton's chief financial officer, at a presentation before the council as a whole on October 25th. This milestone was foreshadowed back on September 13th when the CFO requested from the Committee on Finance and Salaries to transfer more than $2 million from a stabilization account into a project account. Delarusso explained. This is Pamela Ann Peters for the Talking Information Center, reading the Taunton Daily Gazette. Will the fire department move to a new Taunton public safety building? A new public safety building for Taunton's police and fire departments is one step closer to reality. The city recently hired a project manager and design architecture firm to begin the process of determining the what's and how's and when's for this new public safety facility. This administration, this project team, with council support, will get this done. We will have liftoff, said Patrick Della Russo, Taunton's chief financial officer, at a presentation for the council as a whole on October 25th. This milestone was foreshadowed back on September 13th, when the CFO requested from the Committee on Finance and Salaries to transfer more than $2 million from a stabilization account into a project account. Della Russo explained it was to hire a project manager and architects, as well as fund the site surveying and building design process. Della Russo, along with representatives from the project planning professionals and Kahlo and Blennick Architects, were present before the City Council to go over the plans for the next few months for determining the scope, needs, and cost for the proposed new building. The parcel of land chosen for the new public safety building is located at 90 County Street, roughly 40 acres, adjacent to the Honorable Gordon M. Owen Parkway. The city purchased the land from Sisters of St. Dorothy for $1.9 million last year. President Dan Paiota, the project manager for Public Safety Buildings Project, told the City Council that both the P3 and the design firm are currently working on schematics and design development for the proposed complex. He said the intention is not only to meet police and fire's current needs, but also program for the future, so it can adequately be home for both departments for the next 50 to 100 years. Paiota said the timetable everyone is working on is to have the final project design completed by January. He added everyone is working as fast as possible because of the inflationary environment. Della Russo said a city can't start thinking about how the project will be paid for, whether through loans, Proposition 2.5 debt exclusion, ARPA funds, city reserves, or a combination of options until accurate estimates come in. He added, as interest rates rise, it's imperative we need to lock in project costs as well as debt issuance cost. What's about the fire department? It's no secret that Taunton's fire stations are old. Central Fire Station, established in 1869, is the oldest of Taunton's fire stations and one of the oldest continuously operated fire stations in the country. East Taunton Station on Middleborough Avenue was built in 1899. The Weir Street Station was built around 1889. The only fire station built within the last century is the Oakland Station, established in 1999. Meanwhile, Department for the Headquarters of the Police Department has remained in the same temporary location for more than 20 years. The site, 23 Summer Street, was originally a supermarket and was built in the 1950s. The police department moved there in 2001 after moving out of what previously had been the old Armory Reserve Armory building on Pleasant Street, also a temporary location. Della Russo said the police department has been in temporary locations for the past 45 years. I would think a temporary police station would be a year. We're 44 years overdue, said Councillor Christopher Coote. Despite the age and condition of these buildings, there remains debate over whether main operations for the fire department, currently located at Central Fire Station downtown, will actually move into a new public safety building. Paiota said, ultimately, it comes down to the city council, the mayor's office, and the fire chief whether fire will move into a new building. Factors like design, cost, and fulfillment of needs will influence this decision. He added his team is proceeding on the assumption that fire will move in. If it won't be there, the building will have the ability to add fire at a later date, he said. Deal maker or deal breaker? Fire Chief Timothy Bradshaw told the council the deal maker or deal breaker is having space for a designated training facility. It needs to be part of the project. That is the most important thing for us, said Bradshaw, adding he hasn't yet been told to have having the space is definite. Bradshaw explained that if the new building is constructed without this train space, he may opt in for continuing to run operations out of Central Fire while using the current police station on Summer Street, as the new training facility once the police department moves to County Street. I think the fire department benefits there more than moving to County Street without giving us a training facility, Bradshaw said. Strong RSV vaccine data lifts hopes after years of futility. Pfizer says shots highly effective at protecting newborns from interest. New research shows vaccinating pregnant women help protect their newborns from common but scary respiratory virus called RSV that fills hospitals with wheezing babies each year. The preliminary results buoy hope that after decades of failure and frustration, vaccines against RSV may finally be getting close. Pfizer announced Tuesday that a large international study found vaccinating moms-to-be was nearly 82% effective at preventing severe cases of RSV in their baby's most vulnerable first 90 days of life. At age 6 months, the vaccine was still proving 69% effective against serious illness, and there were no signs of safety problems in mothers or babies. Moms are always giving their antibodies to their babies, said virologist Verena Swanson, Pfizer's vice president of viral vaccines. The vaccine just puts them in that much better position to form and pass on RSV-fighting antibodies. The vaccine quest isn't just to protect infants. RSV is dangerous for older adults, too. And both Pfizer and rival GSK recently announced that their repeating shots are also proved protective for seniors. None of the findings will help this year when early RSV surge already is crowding children's hospitals. But they raise the prospect that one or more vaccines might become available before next year's fall's RSV season. My fingers are crossed, said Dr. William Schaffner, an infectious disease specialist at Vanderbilt University. We're making inroads. Tuesday's data was reported in a press release and hasn't been vetted by independent experts. Here's a look at the long quest for RSV vaccines. What is RSV? For most healthy people, RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, is a cold-like nuisance. But for the very young, the elderly, and people with certain health problems, it can be serious, even life-threatening. The virus can infect deep in the lungs, causing pneumonia, and in babies, it can impede air breathing by inflaming tiny airways. In the U.S., about 58,000 children younger than 5 are hospitalized for RSV each year, and several hundred die. Among adults 65 and older, about 177,000 are hospitalized with RSV, and 14,000 die annually. Worldwide, RSV kills about 100,000 children a year, mostly in poor countries. Why is there no vaccine? A tragedy in the 1960s set back the whole field. Using the approach that led to the first polio vaccine, scientists made an experimental RSV vaccine by growing the virus in a lab and killing it. But testing in children found not only was the vaccine not protective, youngsters who caught the RSV after vaccination fared worse. 2 died. For a period of 20 years, even though science was advancing, nobody wanted to go near development of an RSV vaccine, Schaffner said. Even today, modern vaccine candidates were tested first in older adults, not children, he noted. What got development back on track? Most modern vaccines tend to target the outer surface of a virus, what the immune system sees when a germ invades. For RSV, that target is the so-called F protein that helps the virus latch onto human cells. Again, there was a hurdle. That protein is a shapeshifter, rearranging its form before and after it fuses to cells. It turns out that an immune system not only forms effective RSV-fighting antibodies when it spots what's called the prefusion version of that protein, a explained structural biologist Jason McClellan of the University of Texas at Austin. In 2013, McClellan and virologist Barney Graham were working at the National Institutes of Health when they homed in on the correct shape and figured out how to freeze it in that form. That finding opened up the way in today's development of a variety of experimental RSV vaccine candidates. That same discovery was key to the hugely successful COVID-19 vaccines, as the coronavirus also is cloaked in a shape-shifting surface protein. What's in the pipeline? Several companies are creating RSV vaccines, but Pfizer and rival GSK are furthest along. Both companies recently reported final stage testing in older adults. The competing vaccines are made somewhat differently, but each proves strongly effective, especially against serious disease. Both companies seek to plan regulatory approval in the U.S. by the end of the year, as well as in other countries. The older adult data looks fantastic, said McClellan, who has closely followed the vaccine development. I think we're on the right track. And if vaccinating pregnant women pans out, it could be a win for two individuals instead of just one, by offering protection to both mom-to-be and baby, said Dr. William Wilbur Chen of the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Pfizer's maternal vaccine is the same recipe that it tested successfully in older adults, and also plans to seek Food and Drug Administration approval for these vaccines by the year's end. The new study included 7,400 pregnant women in 18 countries, including the U.S., and spanned multiple RSV seasons. Preliminary results reported Tuesday show the vaccine was most effective against severe disease. For milder illness, effectiveness was 51% to 57%, short of the study's statistical requirements, but a result that Pfizer still called clinically meaningful because it could mean fewer trips to the doctor's office. Wednesday Powerball prize soars to $1.2 billion. There were no big treats from the Halloween night Powerball drawing, as none of the tickets sold matched all six numbers. The lack of a winner means the next drawing Wednesday night will be for a massive $1.2 billion jackpot. The winning numbers drawn Monday were white balls 13, 19, 36, 39, 59, and the red Powerball 13. The jackpot will be the fourth largest in U.S. history. The biggest prize was a $1.586 billion Powerball jackpot won by three ticket holders in 2016. Massive lottery jackpots have become more common in recent years as lottery officials have adjusted game rules and ticket prices to pump up the top prices. The most recent tweak came in August when Powerball officials added an additional drawing day, going from a week to three, to build larger prices and boost sales. Although the advertised top prize Wednesday will be an estimated $1.2 billion, that is for winners who receive their winnings through an annuity paid over 29 years. Winners almost always opt for cash, which for Wednesday's night drawing will be an estimated $596 million. No one has hit the jackpot since August 3rd, meaning there have now been 38 consecutive draws without a jackpot winner, a testament to how slim the odds are of winning the jackpot, 1 in 292.2 million. Powerball is played in 45 states, as well as Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. South Korea officials admit culpability in tragedy. Police officers handling urgent calls probed. South Korea officials admitted responsibility and apologized on Tuesday for failures in preventing and responding to a Halloween crowd surge that killed more than 150 people and left citizens shocked and angry. The government is facing growing public scrutiny over whether the crushed Saturday night in Seoul's Itaewon district, a popular nightlife neighborhood, could have been prevented, and who should take responsibility for the country's worst disaster in years. National Police Chief Yoon Hee-kyun said an initial investigation found there were many urgent calls from citizens notifying authorities about the potential danger of the crowd gathering in Itaewon. He said the police officers who received the calls failed to handle them effectively. I feel a heavy responsibility for the disaster, as the head of one of the related government offices, Yoon, said in the televised news conference. Police will do their best to prevent a tragedy like this from happening again. Yoon said police have launched an intense internal probe into the officers' handling of the emergency calls and other issues, such as the on-the-spot response to the crowd surge in Itaewon that night. Separately, South Korea's Interior Minister, Emergency Office Chief, Seoul Mayor, and Head of a Ward Office that includes Itaewon neighborhood all offered public apologies. Seoul Mayor Oh Si-hoon apologized deeply and wept, and briefly halted his news conference as he talked about the parent of a 20-year-old woman who was declared dead earlier in the day. When I tried to comfort a person with a daughter hospitalized at the National Medical Center yesterday, they said their daughter would survive and they believed so. But I heard she passed away this morning. I'm sorry that my apology has come late. The disaster, which left at least 156 people dead and 151 others injured, was concentrated on a narrow downhill alley in Itaewon. Witnesses described people falling on one another, suffering severe breathing difficulties, and falling unconscious. They said rescuers and ambulances failed to reach the cramped alleys in time because the entire Itaewon area was packed with slow-moving vehicles and partygoers clad in Halloween costumes. Most of the dead were in their 20s and 30s, and about two-thirds were women. During a cabinet council meeting Tuesday, President Yoon Suk-yeol acknowledged that South Korea lacks research on crowd management. He called for the use of drones and other high-tech resources to develop an effective crowd control capability, and said the government will soon meet with experts to review national safety rules. The crowd surge in South Korea's deadliest disaster since the 2014 ferry sinking that killed 304 people exposed lax safety rules and regulatory failures. Saturday's surge has raised public questions about what South Korea has done since then to prevent human-made disasters. After the Itaewon disaster, police launched a 475-member task force to find its cause. Brazil truckers protest Bolsonaro loss. Brazilian truckers, supportive of President Jair Bolsonaro, blocked hundreds of roads early Tuesday to protest his election loss to former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Since the leftist da Silva's victory Sunday night, many truck drivers have jammed traffic in areas across the country and said they won't acknowledge Bolsonaro's defeat. Bolsonaro hasn't spoken publicly since the official results were released roughly 36 hours ago, nor has he phoned on da Silva to concede. The highway to and from the international airport in Sao Paulo, Brazil's most populous state and largest economy, was blocked, and dozens of flights were canceled. Videos on social media showed travelers rolling their suitcases at night along the highway to the airport. Access was partially reestablished at 8 a.m. local time. In neighboring Minas Gerais, a key battleground state in the election, a video on social media showed a protester telling a reporter from O Tempo, "We won't stop as long as we don't have a response from our president." The man, wearing a green and yellow shirt, the colors of the Brazilian flag, and the nation's conservative movement, claimed the election was fraudulent and warned of future protest. "We want Bolsonaro in 2023 and for the years to come," he said. In 2018, an 11-day trucker strike brought Brazil to a halt, caused food prices to spike, and left supermarket shelves without products as gas stations ran out of fuel. It caused billions in losses and revealed the vast power that trucker possesses, particularly when they organize through social media platforms. Bolsonaro, a lawmaker at the time and months away from winning that year's presidential election, was an outspoken supporter of the truckers, who became a constituency of his. This year, his administration limited interstate fuel taxes to help bring down prices and launched a financial aid program for truckers just ahead of the presidential election campaign. A majority of Brazilian Supreme Court justices early Tuesday voted to order the Federal Highway Police to clear the blocked roads immediately. The vote was still taking place as of 9 a.m. local time, with partial results posted on the court's website. As of Tuesday morning, highway police had removed nearly 200 blockades, according to the Ministry of Justice. Federal public prosecutors in Sao Paulo and Goiás states said they had opened investigations into the blockades. De Silva's workers' parties accused Bolsonaro's campaign of deploying police force to create traffic jams and deter people from voting on Election Day, when videos of officials stopping buses shot across social media. The party said the alleged efforts are particularly focused in the northeast region that is a workers' party stronghold. Alexander de Moraes, who presides over the nation's electoral authority, said police checkpoints merely delayed voters from reaching polls. He ordered the immediate suspension of all highway police operations. A Acushnet couple wants to reintroduce you to Portugal, one bottle at a time. New Bedford neighbors Chris and Nellie Sareva are focused on reintroducing you to Portugal. More than a motto for their new startup brands of Portugal, they say the catchphrase is a testament to the desire to share with others their love for Portugal and the rich culture and history of their ancestors' homeland. Portugal is part of our heritage and our hearts, said Chris Sareva, while explaining the concept behind the unique wine and spirits importing and distribution company he and his wife Nellie founded about a year ago. We want the opportunity to take people on a journey and experience all that is Portugal, and we want to make it about the experience, he stressed. Based in Rumford, Rhode Island, Brands of Portugal, as the name implies, exclusively represents wine producers and distilleries from Portugal. The company's portfolio is predominantly composed of products from smaller boutique wineries scattered all over the country. As Nellie Sareva pointed out, many times wine mass-produced by corporate wineries just don't receive the handcrafted care and attention that small producers live for. In addition to quality, we look at many things when we bring in a producer, she said. We want to be a good representation for Portugal's top unique products. We're really looking at what they're doing with their wine and how they're producing it. Sustainability is a huge part of it, and so are organic pork practices. When the idea of starting Brands of Portugal first crossed their mind, it was both exciting and overwhelming, they said. The two were already successful entrepreneurs. He as a wedding DJ, and she as a wedding and boudoir photographer. In 2009, they had opened a joint studio in downtown New Bedford. Our idea for Brands of Portugal was born from the concept of creating an outlet where we can connect with people, share experiences, and create memories, Nellie Sareva said. The pandemic actually gave them the push they needed. The forced professional pause imposed by COVID not only ended up fueling their plan, but accelerating its fruition. While they live in Acushnet, they said that Rhode Island seemed like a natural location for their startup because nearly 70% of their wedding businesses were conducted in the Ocean State, and they had a lot of contacts there. The couple used their unexpected free time to research the history and vision of Portuguese wineries and distilleries and understand the labor-intensive work that goes into each of their products. They followed up with virtual meetings with producers. Once international traveling instructions were lifted, they visited Portugal on two different occasions to personally chat with their producers, tour their properties, and taste their products. Brands of Portugal currently represents more than two dozen producers, including Adega de Porto Alegre, Herdade de Sabroso, Justinas Madeira Wines, and Pico Wines, and Quinta da Pacheca, among others. They are the sole distributors of the West India Madeira wine in this country. In fact, they even create the label for the five-year-old reserve wine that produced and bottled by Justinas Madeira Wines, the suppliers of Madeira wine for New Bedford's Feast of the Blessed Sacrament. This wine is our baby, said Chris Severa proudly. It's our private label for the entire United States. The story in the back of the bottle is like our journey. It's a reflection during highs and lows. This Madeira wine took a path, often diverted, where temperatures were high, seas were rough, and the journey was long. It ended up being this incredible, fortified wine. We knew that the story we wanted to tell of our journey and everyone's journey through COVID, which was going to be told in this bottle of Madeira wine. The Saraiva said they not only want to be a vehicle for people to discover the many wonderful wines Portugal has to offer, but to learn more about the winemakers and experience the country's beauty, vast culture, and rich history. We want to provide people with resources to learn about Portugal and its wine history, take them on tours of the country's wineries, and introduce them to the people that make the country so special, said Nelly Saraiva, the daughter of immigrants hailing from Brentana, Inverness, São Miguel, and the Azores. Her husband traces his roots to Linhares de Beira and Porto in mainland Portugal, and Faial in the Azores. We're not the first wholesakers, but we are bringing up the level of what's available, she said. And they want to make it an experience as personable as possible. We're telling the stories of about 25 producers, she said. We're telling you about the individual stories behind the wine production, and a lot of these are family products. Using their skills and attention to detail, the Saraivas have put together a 60-page Brands of Portugal Wine Spirits Guide, telling the stories of some of the producers they represent and showcasing their products. He designed it and she took dozens of photographs to highlight the winemakers, their properties, and different regions of the country. We look at these producers as partners, Chris Saraiva said. To have an ambitious goal and to succeed with it, you have to have people to walk beside you with a common vision. We look at these people as families. When we sell you a bottle of wine, we can tell you their names, and for me, that brings it to a different level. To further promote the producers and products, they plan to host educational tasting events, and they have teamed up with some sommeliers and wine educators. Chris's father, Joe Saraiva, who has more than 3 decades of experience in the wine business, recently joined the startup. We need to have events to really showcase everything, said Nelly Saraiva. We already had some wine dinners, including one at the Hotel Province, for about 46 people, and plan to have more. That's about all the time we have for the news for today. This has been Pamela Ann Peters for the Talking Information Center, reading the Taunton Daily Gazette.
Just heard news stories from the Taunton Daily Gazette. Please stay tuned for more programming.
Take a look under your bed. Find stuff under there? What about jobs? No? Now try your basement. There's a pair of overalls that overall you're not so into anymore. A perfectly good laptop that hasn't sat in your lap in months. And even more stuff, but still no jobs? Well, you really have both. See, stuff is defined as household articles considered as a group. Sometimes this stuff is no longer needed. Wait, no longer needed? That can't be right. Because remember those jobs you were looking for? Those are really needed, and they're the stuff inside your stuff. Even inside that winter coat that moved with you to Phoenix. Our job is to unlock those jobs, and it starts when you donate your stuff to your local Goodwill. Here's how we do it. When you donate to Goodwill, we sell your stuff to provide job training for people right here in your community. So just by teaming up with Goodwill, you help create jobs. And isn't that worth parting with the leftover keytar from your 80s cover band? Goodwill. Donate stuff, create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is John Andrasik of Five for Fighting, here for RAD, the entertainment industry's voice for road safety. You know, style is a personal thing, and your lifestyle is your business. But if you take it on the road, it becomes everybody's business. So please, plan ahead, designate before you celebrate. Friends, don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Jill, why don't you tell the class what you did this weekend?
Well, my dad and I went in search of some magical minnows and found a zillion of them in the stream from our lookout rock. Then my sister and I escaped from an evil slug king and went back to my super twig fort for safety. Then we told stories till it got dark and the Big Dipper led us all the way home. Whoa!
Where were you, Jill?
We went to the forest. It's not that far away.
Ask your parents to take you and your friends to the forest this week. It's closer than you think. Check out discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books.